conservative Leninist model of a revolutionary party to the local tradition of Sufi brotherhoods. In 1973, at their first meeting as the leadership council of the Muslim Youth Organization, the group elected Rabbani its chairman and Sayaf vice chairman. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar did not make it to the inaugural meeting of the Muslim Youth Organization that night in 1973. He was in jail for ordering the murder of a Maoist student, but the group selected him as its political director anyway, because in his short time as a student in Kabul University's elite engineering school, Hekmatyar had already earned a reputation as a committed radical. He was willing, it seemed, to protest anything. When the university tried to raise the passing grade from 50 to 60, Hekmatyar cursed the school's administrators and stood on the front lines of mass demonstrations. He shook his fist at the government's un-Islamic ways and was rumored to spray acid in the faces of young women who dared set foot in public without donning a veil. Masood kept his distance from Hekmatyar, but Rabbani's teachings appealed to him. Just to hear Rabbani speak, he frequently hiked around the hill from the institute to Kabul University's Sharia faculty, a 1950s-era brick and flagstone building resembling an American middle school that nestled in a shaded vale near Ali Abad Mountain. By the time King Zahir Shah's cousin, Mohammed Daoud, drawing on some communist support, seized national power in a coup on July 17, 1973, Masood was a full-fledged member of the Muslim Youth Organization. "Some of our brothers deem armed struggle necessary to topple this criminal government," Rabbani declared at one meeting at the Faculty of Islamic Law a few months later. "They acquired weapons and built connections in the Afghan army, but they lacked a path to power." When Daoud cracked down on the Islamists a year later, Masood, Hekmatyar, Rabbani, and the rest of the organization's members fled to Pakistan. The Pakistani government embraced them. Daoud's nascent communist support had the Pakistani army worried. The exiled Islamists offered the army a way to pursue influence in Afghanistan. Masood, Hekmatyar, and about 5,000 other young exiles began secret military training under the direction of Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's Afghan affairs advisor, Brigadier General Nasirullah Babar. Babar and Hekmatyar, both ethnic Pashtuns, soon became confidants, and together they hatched the plan for an uprising against Daoud in 1975. They drafted Masood to sneak back into the Panjshir and start the revolt from there. He did so reluctantly, and the episode ended badly. Masood fled to Pakistan for the second time in 2 years. The failed uprising exacerbated a split among the Afghan exiles, with bad blood all around. Hekmatyar created his own organization, Hezb-e-Islami, Islamic Party, composed primarily of ethnic Pashtuns, and he forged close relations with ISI. Masood stuck by Rabbani in Jamaat-e-Islami, Islamic Society, which was made up mostly of ethnic Tajiks. When Masood secretly returned to the Panjshir Valley once again in 1978, however, he did so on his own. He no longer trusted the other Afghan leaders, and he had no faith in Pakistan. He simply showed up in the Panjshir with 30 supporters, 17 rifles, the equivalent of $130 in cash, and a letter asking the local people to declare jihad against their Soviet-backed government. By his 30th birthday, Masood had fended off 6 direct assaults by the world's largest conventional army. The Politburo and the high command of the Soviet 40th Army had initially hoped that Soviet troops might play a supporting role in Afghanistan, backing up the communist-led Afghan army. Kremlin officials repeatedly assured themselves that the rebels were nothing more than basmachi, or bandits, the term used to describe Muslim rebels in Central Asia who unsuccessfully resisted Soviet authority following the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. But desertions from Afghan army ranks only increased. Massive, forcible conscription drives inflated the Afghan army's reported size, but did little to improve its effectiveness. Gradually, Soviet units took the war on for themselves. Masood and his Panjshiri rebels stood near the top of their target list. The Panjshir Valley contained only about 80,000 residents in a country of 15 million, but for the Soviets the valley proved vital. Just to the east of the Panjshir, through a forbidding mountain range, the Salang Highway cut a path between Kabul and Termez, the Soviet transit city on the Afghan border beside the Amu Darya River. For the Soviets to retain their grip on Afghanistan, the Salang Highway had to remain open. There was no other reliable overland supply route between the USSR and Kabul. Food, uniforms, fuel, weapons, ammunition, everything the Red Army and the Afghan Army required rumbled down the Salang's treacherous, pitted zigzag blacktop. The Salang kept Massoud's forces fed, clothed, and armed as well. When a Soviet convoy tried to pass along the highway, Massoud's fighters streamed down from the mountains, unleashed a fusillade of gunfire, raided the convoy, and disappeared back into the shadows. They would then take apart whatever they had pilfered from the Soviets, be it an anti-tank missile or pieces of a tank, pack it onto the backs of horses, and trek to the Panjshir where mechanics reassembled them for the rebels' future use. Because Massoud had access to the Salang from the Panjshir, Red Army soldiers were dying at the hands of Red Army weapons fired by Mujahideen clothed in Red Army uniforms. "We do not regard an attack against a convoy successful, even if we destroy many trucks or tanks, unless we bring back supplies," Massoud told a visiting journalist in 1981. Massoud, the Soviets decided, was one bandit they had to stop quickly. In each of the first six Soviet assaults on the Panjshir between the spring of 1980 and the fall of 1982, Massoud hardly seemed to stand a chance. At the time of the first campaign, he had barely 1,000 fighters. 2 years later, that number had doubled, but he was still grossly outgunned. With each invasion, the Soviets brought more men and more firepower. For the fall 1982 offensive, the Soviets sent 10,000 of their own troops, 4,000 Afghan army soldiers, and scores of tanks, attack helicopters, and fighter jets from Kabul. Not only aimed at securing the Salang, the assaults were part of a wider, unannounced military plan. The Soviets had decided that to hold Afghanistan for the long run, they should achieve a decisive victory in the northern zones bordering the Soviet Union first, according to the KGB's archives. Massoud had become a serious, deeply read student of Mao Zedong, Che Guevara, and French revolutionary strategist Régis Debray. Following their precepts, he did not try to face the Soviets and stop them. From the earliest days of the rebellion, he maintained well-placed intelligence agents in the Afghan army and typically would find out days, weeks, or even months in advance that the Soviets were planning an attack. Just before the first aerial bombing runs began, Massoud's forces would melt away into the intricate network of side valleys that spread out from the Panjshir like veins on a leaf. After the bombs had fallen, the Soviet and Afghan army ground forces would enter the valley and find it populated by women, children, old men, and a smattering of farm animals. But they would not find any Mujahideen, at least not initially. Massoud might allow a column of Soviet tanks to advance well into the valley before ordering his men to attack. When they did, they would never stand and fight head-on. Instead, they might send a few particularly courageous soldiers to streak in with rocket-propelled grenades and take out the first and last tanks in the column. Larger rebel contingents, well hidden behind rocks and trees, would then spray the paralyzed column with gunfire before sprinting back to the safety of a side valley. In the narrow Panjshir, with only one road in and out, the Red Army soldiers often had no choice but to abandon their tanks. The crippled vehicles, with a little tinkering by Massoud's mechanics, sometimes became part of the Mujahideen arsenal within a week. Massoud played the Afghan government soldiers off against their Soviet allies. A staggeringly large percentage of the army felt more allegiance to rebel leaders such as Massoud than they did to their Soviet handlers. In some cases, Massoud even had to persuade sympathizers within the Afghan army not to defect because they were more valuable to him as informers than they were as fighters. During Panjshir invasions, the Soviets often sent Afghan units just ahead of Red Army units on the theories that their Afghan comrades would then bear the brunt of the Mujahideen surprises. In time, Massoud picked up on this tactic and began to exploit it. When his lookouts spotted an enemy column advancing with Afghan forces in the lead, Massoud's men would try to isolate the units by blasting gigantic rocks out of the cliffs and hurtling them toward the road, in between where the Afghan units ended and the Soviet units began. More often than not, Rather than put up a fight, the Afghan army soldiers defected immediately, bringing to the Mujahideen side whatever weapons and munitions they happened to be carrying. The Soviets did not have the luxury of surrendering. Asked why there were no Red Army soldiers in his prisons, Massoud replied, "Hatred for the Russians is just too great. Many Mujahideen have lost their families or homes through communist terror. Their first reaction when coming across a Russian is to kill him." By the time he repelled his sixth Soviet offensive in 1982, Massoud had made a name for himself nationwide. He was the Lion of the Panjshir. The word Panjshir itself had become a rallying cry across Afghanistan and abroad, a symbol of hope for the anti-communist resistance. Within the narrow valley, Massoud was a hero, popular enough to have his own cult of personality and exert dictatorial control. Instead, he operated his rebellion through councils that provided Panjshiri elders and civilians, as well as subordinate rebel commanders, a voice in his affairs. As a result, he was more constrained by local public opinion than rebel leaders who operated out of ISI-funded offices in Pakistani exile. The Pakistan-based commanders took advantage of the refugee camps spreading around Peshawar and Quetta. Food rations were controlled by Hekmatyar, Sayaf Rabbani, and other ISI-supported Mujahideen leaders. Hekmatyar especially used the camps as a blend of civilian refuge, military encampment, and political operations center. Massoud, on the other hand, ran his guerrilla army entirely inside Afghan territory and relied on the forbearance of Afghan civilians living under repeated vicious Soviet attacks. Massoud ran local police and civil affairs committees in the Panjshir and levied taxes on emerald and lapis miners. His militias depended directly on popular support. There were many other examples of indigenous revolutionary leadership emerging across Afghanistan, but Massoud was becoming the most prominent leader of what the French scholar Olivier Roy called the only contemporary revivalist Muslim movement to take root among peasants. In Massoud's movement, the fighting group is the civil society, with the same leadership and no professionalization of fighters. Soviet scorched earth tactics began to lay the land and its people to waste. Relentless Soviet bombing claimed thousands of civilian lives. By the end of 1982, more than 80% of the Panjshir's buildings had been damaged or destroyed. In an attempt to starve the valley out, the Soviets even resorted to that most infamous of Iron Curtain tactics. They built a wall. The 6-foot-high concrete barrier at the southern mouth of the valley was intended to keep food and clothing from getting to the Panjshiris. It didn't work. The Mujahideen managed to smuggle in everything from biscuits to chewing gum to transistor radios. But with their crops in ruins, their livestock slaughtered, and no end to the fighting in sight, it was unclear how much more hardship the valley's population could bear. Massoud decided to cut a deal. In the spring of 1983, he announced an unprecedented truce. Under its terms, the Soviets would stop attacking in the Panjshir if Massoud allowed the Afghan army to operate a base at the southern end of the valley. The truce followed 3 years of secret negotiations. For as long as Massoud had been fighting the Soviets, most Afghans outside the Panjshir Valley were shocked to learn he had also been talking with them. The conversation started as letters exchanged with Soviet commanders across the front lines. In these, Massoud and his enemy counterparts conversed like colleagues. Later, they held face-to-face meetings. In the final two sessions, Massoud brokered the terms personally. Writing from Moscow, Yuri Andropov, the former KGB chief and now Brezhnev's successor as General Secretary of the Communist Party, formally endorsed the agreement for the Soviets. Many in Afghanistan and abroad saw the truce as a craven capitulation. Massoud's deal was a blow to the Mujahideen, just as Benedict Arnold was a blow to the Americans, one American pundit declared. Leaders of Jamaat, Massoud's own party, felt particularly betrayed, since Massoud had not bothered to consult them beforehand. The shock of Massoud's truce helped strengthen his rival Hekmatyar. Pakistani intelligence, for years disdainful of non-Pashtun clients in northern Afghanistan, cited the deal when explaining to CIA counterparts why Massoud had to be cut off completely. "He set a policy of local ceasefire, recalled Brigadier General Siedraza Ali, who worked in ISI's Afghan bureau throughout the 1980s. So a man who's working against the Afghan war, why should we deal with him? Already strong, Hekmatyar emerged as the most powerful of ISI's Pakistan-based Mujahideen clients, just as Charlie Wilson and Bill Casey, along with Prince Turki, suddenly poured hundreds of millions of dollars worth of new and more lethal supplies into ISI warehouses. Hekmatyar had matured into a cold, ruthless, effective leader who tolerated no dissent and readily ordered the deaths of his opponents. He enhanced his power by running the tightest, most militaristic organization in Peshawar and in the refugee camps. One could rely on them blindly, recalled the ISI Brigadier Yusuf, who worked closely with Hekmatyar. By giving them the weapons, you were sure that weapons will not be sold in Pakistan, because he was strict to the extent of being ruthless. Chuckling morbidly, Yusuf added, "Once you join his party, it was difficult to leave." Hekmatyar followed the totalitarian model of integrating all powers into the party, as the American scholar Barnett Rubin put it. Hekmatyar's Pashtun family came from a lesser tribal federation forcibly removed during the 19th century from the Pakistani border areas to a northern province of Afghanistan, Kunduz, not far from the Panjshir. That his family's tribal roots were of minority status within the Pashtun community made Hekmatyar attractive to Pakistani intelligence, which wanted to build up Pashtun clients outside of Afghanistan's traditional royal tribes. Hekmatyar attended high school in Kunduz and military school in Kabul before enrolling in the prestigious Faculty of Engineering at Kabul University. Once in Pakistani exile, he gathered around him the most radical, anti-Western, transnational Islamists fighting in the jihad, including bin Laden and other Arabs who arrived as volunteers. The older Muslim Brotherhood-influenced leaders, such as Rabbani and Sayaf, regarded Hekmatyar's group as a rash offshoot. The more professorial Afghan Islamists spoke of broad global Islamic communities and gradual moral evolution. Not Hekmatyar. He was focused on power. His Islamic Party organization became the closest thing to an exiled army in the otherwise diverse, dispersed jihad. He adhered to Qutb's view about the need to vanquish corrupt Muslim leaders in order to establish true Islamic government. He took it upon himself to decide who was a true believer and who was an apostate. Over the centuries, Afghan warfare had aimed at restoring the balance of power, not at destroying the enemy. As the scholar Olivier Roy put it, Hekmatyar, on the other hand, wanted to destroy his enemies. These included not only communist and Soviet occupation forces, but Mujahideen competitors. He recognized Massoud as his most formidable military rival and began early on to attack him in the field and through maneuverings in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. "We have a saying in Pashto," Hekmatyar told an Arab supporter who worried about the growing intensity of his rivalry with Massoud. "There is a rooster who is so conceited it walks on the ceiling on his toes because he's afraid that the roof would fall. That rooster is Massoud." In his drive for power during the mid-1980s, Hekmatyar so often attacked Massoud and other Mujahideen that intelligence analysts in Washington feared he might be a secret KGB plant whose mission was to sow disruption within the anti-communist resistance. Yet both at headquarters and in the field, CIA officers in the Near East Division who were running the Afghan program also embraced Hekmatyar as their most dependable and effective ally. ISI officers urged Hekmatyar upon the CIA, and the agency concluded independently that he was the most efficient at killing Soviets. They believed this because as they reviewed battlefield damage reports, tracked the movements of weapons shipments, and toured the refugee camps to check on organizational strength among Mujahideen parties, analytically, the best fighters, the best organized fighters, were the fundamentalists, led by Hekmatyar, as one officer then at headquarters put it. William Pikeney, the CIA station chief, would drive down from Islamabad with ISI officers or visiting congressmen to meet with Hekmatyar in the rock-strewn border training camps. He admired Hekmatyar's fighting ability, but among the Mujahideen leaders, it was also Hekmatyar who gave him the deepest chills. I would put my arms around Gulbuddin, and we'd hug, you know, like brothers in combat and stuff. And his coal-black eyes would look back at you, and you just knew that there was only one thing holding this team together, and that was the Soviet Union. At least Hekmatyar knew who the enemy was, the CIA's officers and analysts assured themselves. Massoud's truce with the Soviets, on the other hand, was his first public demonstration that, in addition to being a military genius, he was also willing to cut a deal with anyone, at any time, and in any direction, if he thought it would advance his goals. Massoud felt the truce would raise his stature by placing him on equal footing with a superpower. "The Russians have negotiated with a valley," his aide Massoud Khalili crowed. The deal also brought Massoud time to regroup for what he had determined would be a long, long fight ahead. He sought not only to resist the Soviets, but to compete for power in Kabul and on a national stage, as the revolutionaries he admired from his reading had done. Despite the uncertainties of the war, he planned early for a conventional army that could occupy Kabul after the Soviets left. He used the period during the ceasefire, more than a year, as it turned out, to stockpile weapons and food for his critically malnourished and poorly armed troops. Panjshiri farmers, who hadn't enjoyed a peaceful growing season in several years, harvested crops unmolested, and many of his troops ranged to other parts of the country, building alliances on Massoud's behalf with Mujahideen commanders who had never been to the Panjshir. Massoud also capitalized on the calm to attack Hekmatyar's forces. Before the truce, a group aligned with Hekmatyar's party had been using an adjacent valley, the Andarab, to stage assaults on Massoud's flank and cut off his supply lines. With one swift commando raid, Massoud drove these fighters out of the valley and, for the time being, off his back. It was an opening action in an emerging war within the Afghan war. By the time the truce began to unravel in the spring of 1984, Massoud was breezing through the Panjshir in a distinguished new black Volga sedan. The car had been intended as a gift from the Soviets for the Afghan defense minister, but Massoud's guerrillas picked it off on its way down the Salang Highway and hauled it back to the Panjshir in hundreds of pieces as a gift for their commander. The Soviets signaled their displeasure by sending an undercover Afghan agent into the Panjshir. The agent took a shot at Massoud from 30 feet away, but missed. The assassination attempt exposed two other Afghan communist agents in the rebels' midst, including a Massoud cousin who had also been one of his commanders. Massoud's own spy network remained a step ahead. In the spring of 1984, he learned that the Soviets intended to launch a 20,000-man assault on the valley. Not only would the invasion be larger than anything seen before, but according to Massoud's sources, the tactics would be far more ruthless. The Soviets planned to subject the valley to a week's worth of high-altitude aerial assaults, and then sow the bomb-tilled soil with landmines to make it uninhabitable for years to come. Massoud ordered the entire Panjshir Valley to evacuate in late April. 3 days before Soviet bombers soared above its gorges, he led more than 40,000 Panjshiris out of the valley and into hiding. When Soviet ground troops, including numerous special forces units known as Spetsnaz, moved in a week later, they found the Panjshir Valley utterly ruined and almost completely deserted. From the concealed cave surrounding the Panjshir, where Massoud re-established his organization, he cautiously plotted his return. His men launched operations from the ridgelines, shooting down at the helicopters that canvassed the valley floor. They ambushed the enemy, created diversions, and fought at night when the Soviets were most vulnerable. But the introduction of the elite Spetsnaz, along with their advanced MiG-24D Hind attack helicopters and communications gear, gradually shifted warfighting tactics in the Soviets' favor. As many as 2,000 Spetsnaz were deployed in Afghanistan during 1984, and the MiG-24's armor-coated belly repulsed nearly all the anti-aircraft guns available to the Mujahideen. Massoud's men found themselves pursued on foot by heavily armed Spetsnaz troops who could scramble up the valley's rugged cliffs almost as fast as the locals. Kabul radio reported that Massoud had been killed in action. When an interviewer late that spring asked Afghan President Babrak Karmal whether Massoud was alive or dead, Karmal dismissed the question. "Who is this Massoud that you speak of?" he asked contemptuously. U.S. propaganda creates artificial personalities and false gods. As an actor, Reagan knows well how to create puppets on the international stage. These creations are clay idols that disintegrate just as fast. Massoud was an instrument of the imperialists. I don't know if he is alive or dead, and I don't care. The Panjshir issue has been resolved. It had not been, but Massoud was reeling. It has become a very hard war, far harder than before, the commander acknowledged to a visitor in between sips of tea while ensconced deep within one of his innumerable caves. Their commandos have learned a great deal about mountain guerrilla warfare and are fighting much better than before. CIA analysts said the same in reports they circulated from Langley. The Soviet campaign in the Panjshir that spring featured increased use of hellebore assaults, one such report said, along with an unprecedented high-altitude bombing campaign. Yet Massoud's advance warning of the assault and his covert evacuation of civilians made the difference because Soviet intelligence apparently failed to discover that most guerrillas and their civilian supporters had left the valley. At the same time, the CIA knew that the civil war now gathering momentum between Massoud and Hekmatyar was undermining the jihad. Intramural battles between the two groups have hampered operations and resupply efforts of Massoud's Panjshir Valley insurgents, the CIA's classified report said. Until late 1984 and early 1985, Massoud had received relatively little outside assistance. The British Intelligence Service, MI6, which operated out of a small, windowless office in Britain's Islamabad embassy, made contact with Massoud early in the war and provided him with money, a few weapons, and some communications equipment. British intelligence officers taught English to some of Massoud's trusted aides, such as his foreign policy liaison, Abdullah. The French, too, reached out to Massoud. Unburdened by the CIA's rules, which prohibited travel in Afghanistan, both intelligence services sent officers overland into the Panjshir, posing as journalists. The CIA relied on British intelligence for reports about Massoud. At Langley, there was probably a little penis envy of these border-hopping European spies. You know, they were going in, as one officer involved put it. The French especially grated, trying to find some liberator character in the person of Massoud, making him out as an Afghan Simon Bolivar, George Washington. Massoud charmed his British and French visitors. He dressed more stylishly than other Afghans. He spoke some French. His manner was calm and confident, never blustery. He was never emotional or subjective, as his aide Khalili put it. Always he was objective. He horsed around lightly with his trusted senior commanders, pushing them in the water when they went swimming or teasing them as they went off together on dangerous missions. And while he prayed 5 times a day and fought unyieldingly in Allah's name, drawing on the radical texts he had learned at Kabul Polytechnic Institute, he seemed to outsiders more tolerant, more humane, and more rooted in the land than many other Afghan resistance commanders. The CIA, honoring its agreement with Zia to work solely through ISI, had no direct contacts with Massoud during the early 1980s. ISI officers in the Afghan Bureau saw the British playing their own game with Massoud, which provided yet another reason to withhold support from him. But the CIA did begin in late 1984 to secretly pass money and light supplies to Massoud without telling Pakistan. He was never a problem in any sense that he was the enemy or that we were trying to cut him off, according to one CIA officer involved. But neither was the CIA ready to spend a lot of time and energy trying to push Massoud forward. Massoud swore fealty to Rabbani, but relations between them were badly strained. Rabbani received ample supplies from ISI at his Peshawar offices, but often did not pass much along to Massoud. Rabbani was not a fool. He's a politician, the ISI's Youssef recalled. He cannot make a man stronger than him. Rabbani wanted to build up his own influence across Afghanistan by recruiting Pashtun, Uzbek, and Shiite commanders, securing their loyalty with weapons. In doing so, he sought to limit Massoud's relative power. As a result, almost everything Massoud's forces owned, they scavenged from the enemy, including Massoud's own clothes. red army fatigues, and Afghan army boots. Occasionally, Rabbani might send him a care package, originating with ISI or the Saudis, in the form of all the supplies that a dozen horses can carry. But Western journalists who spent months with Massoud's fighters in the early 1980s returned from the Panjshir with reports that U.S.-funded assistance to the Mujahideen was nowhere to be found. As the fighting grew more difficult, Massoud had to admit he needed outside help. He refused to leave Afghanistan, but he began to send his brothers out of the country, to Peshawar, London, and Washington, to make contact with the CIA officers and Pakistani generals who controlled the covert supply lines. Among the items on his wish list were portable rations and vitamins to help his troops stay nourished, an X-ray machine to diagnose the wounded, infrared goggles and aiming devices for nighttime fighting, radios to improve coordination among commanders, and above all, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft rockets to defend against helicopters and planes. With that kind of support, Massoud thought he could force the Soviets back to the negotiating table within 6 months. Without it, the war could last 40 years. Massoud didn't know it, but in Washington that spring of 1985, some of his American admirers had reached similar conclusions. 7. The terrorists will own the world. In his rising enthusiasm for the Afghan war, and in his determination to punish the Soviets to the greatest possible degree, William Casey found that he needed allies outside of CIA headquarters. Time did little to shake his belief that the CIA's career clandestine officers were too timid. But there were influential conservatives in the executive branch who could aid his push for a more potent covert war. The Reagan administration had attracted to Washington an awful lot of Soldier of Fortune readers, recalled Frank Anderson, a clandestine service officer involved in the Afghan program. These mercenary voyeurs included blunt paramilitary types such as Casey's friend Oliver North, and more cerebral anti-communist hawks who came from right-wing think tanks. Casey connected with these allies as they developed a new plan for the Afghan jihad. Known as National Security Decision Directive 166, with an annex classified top secret / code word, the blueprint they produced became the legal basis for a massive escalation of the CIA's role in Afghanistan starting in 1985. The new policy document provided a retroactive rationale for the huge increases in covert funds forced into the Afghan program late in 1984 by Charlie Wilson. It also looked forward to a new era of direct infusions of advanced U.S. military technology into Afghanistan, intensified training of Islamist guerrillas in explosives and sabotage techniques, and targeted attacks on Soviet military officers designed to demoralize the Soviet high command. Among other consequences, these changes pushed the CIA, along with its clients in the Afghan resistance and in Pakistani intelligence, closer to the gray fields of assassination and terrorism. The meetings that produced NSDD 166 changed the way the United States directed its covert Afghan program. For the first time, the CIA lost its near-total control. The peculiar Washington institution known as the interagency process became dominant. This was typical of national security policymaking by the 1980s. Representatives from various agencies and cabinet departments, selected for their relevance to the foreign policy issue at hand, would form under supervision from the White House's National Security Council. The committee often selected a vague name with a tongue-twisting acronym that could be bandied about as a secret membership code. During the Reagan administration, the CIA worked continuously with one such group, the Planning and Coordination Group, or PCG, the president's unpublicized body for the oversight of all secret covert actions. With Casey's cooperation, the sweeping review of Afghan covert action was taken on early in 1985 by a PCG subset, the Policy Review Group, which began to meet in a high-ceilinged warren of the old executive office building next door to the West Wing of the White House. A striking gray-gabled building imitating the styles of the French Renaissance, with capped peaks and sloping bays that spoke elaborately to 17th Street's bland marble office boxes. The old executive office building housed many of the national security personnel who couldn't fit inside the cramped west wing. Casey kept an office there. Behind most of its tall doors lay regional National Security Council directorates. Here, delegates from Langley, the Pentagon, and the State Department's headquarters building in the nearby Washington neighborhood known as Foggy Bottom would all tramp in to review operations, debate policy, and prepare documents for presidential signature. The new interagency group on Afghanistan, meeting in Room 208, forced the CIA to share a table with civilians and uniformed officers from the Pentagon. In early 1985, the most influential new figure was Freddie Clay, a former director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and an elegant anti-communist hardliner. With him came Michael Pillsbury, an eager former congressional aide. With E. Clay's support, Pillsbury pushed a draft of NSDD 166 for Reagan's signature. For a mid-level aide with little authority on paper beyond his high-level security clearances, he defined his mission ambitiously. To help Afghan rebels overcome rising Soviet military pressure, he wanted to provide them with the best guerrilla weapons and satellite intelligence. To do this, Pillsbury needed new legal authority for CIA covert action that went beyond the Carter-era policy goal of harassing Soviet occupation forces. He sought to expand dramatically the stated aims and the military means of the CIA's Afghan jihad. The agency's career officers at the Near East Division saw Pillsbury as a reckless amateur. Pillsbury saw himself as a principled conservative who refused to be cowed by cautious agency bureaucrats. He wanted to define the purpose of the CIA's efforts in Afghanistan as victory over the Soviet forces. That language seemed too stark to CIA officers and state diplomats. Falling back, Pillsbury suggested they define the jihad's goal as to drive the Soviets out. This, too, seemed provocative to other committee members. In the end, they settled on language that directed the CIA to use all available means to support the Mujahideen's drive for a free Afghanistan. Pillsbury attracted support by offering budgetary blank checks to every agency remotely involved in Afghanistan, state, the Agency for International Development, the United States Information Agency, and the Pentagon. Casey's CIA would remain in the lead, working mainly through Pakistan's ISI. But the CIA would also be given new authority to operate on its own outside of Pakistani eyesight. Other departments were encouraged to submit ambitious plans that could be integrated with the CIA's work. The new policy was that everybody gets to do what everybody wants to in support of the Mujahideen, Pillsbury recalled. Everybody got what they wanted into this document, and in return for all this harmony, the goal got changed. President Reagan signed the classified NSDD 166, titled Expanded U.S. Aid to Afghan Guerrillas, in March 1985, formally anointing its confrontational language as covert U.S. policy in Afghanistan. His national security adviser, Robert McFarlane, signed the highly classified 16-page annex, which laid out specific new steps to be taken by the CIA. For the first time, the agency could use satellite photographs of the Afghan battlefield to help the Mujahideen plan attacks on Soviet targets. The agency would soon send in secure burst communications sets that would allow the rebels to use advanced American technology to thwart Soviet interception of their radio traffic. The CIA would begin, for the first time, to recruit substantial numbers of unilateral agents in Afghanistan, agents who would be undeclared and unknown to Pakistani intelligence. Also for the first time, by at least one account, the document explicitly endorsed direct attacks on individual Soviet military officers. Rapidly ebbing now were the romanticized neo-colonial days of Howard Hart's tour in the Islamabad station, a hands-off era of antique rifles, tea-sipping liaisons, and ink-splotched secret shipping manifests. Some of the agency's career officers in the Near East Division were not enthusiastic about the changes, especially the ones that contemplated attacks on Soviet officers. They saw Pillsbury and his cowboy civilian ilk as dragging the CIA out of its respectable core business of espionage and into the murky, treacherous realm of an escalating dirty war. At one interagency committee meeting in the spring of 1985, Fred E. Clay proposed skipping over Pakistani intelligence altogether by flying American C-130s over Afghanistan and dropping weapons caches to Afghan commanders by parachute. Someone asked, "What if the Russians begin shooting down the U.S. planes and ignite World War III?" E. Clay answered, according to Thomas Twetton, a senior officer in the CIA's clandestine service. "World War III. It's not such a bad idea." If he said such a thing, E. Clay said later, he must have been kidding. But Twetton remembered, a room full of dumbstruck people. Shooting Soviet officers was equally troubling to some at the agency. The CIA and KGB had settled during the 1980s into a shaky, unwritten gentleman's agreement that sought to discourage targeting each other's salaried professional officers for kidnapping or murder. If that agreement broke down, there could be chaos in CIA stations worldwide. CIA officers in Pakistan made a point of treating gently the rare Soviet prisoners taken on the Afghan battlefield. The agency's officers figured this would help American military officers and spies captured by Soviet forces on other Cold War proxy battlefields. But the congressmen writing the CIA's budgetary checks now wanted to start killing Soviet officers serving in Afghanistan. Senator Gordon Humphrey traveled to Kabul at one point and came home crowing about how you could see Soviet generals in the windows of their tattered concrete apartment blocks. All the Mujahideen needed were some long-range sniper rifles, and they could start picking them off one at a time. Increasingly, too, under ISI direction, the Mujahideen received training and malleable explosives to mount car bomb and even camel bomb attacks in Soviet-occupied cities, usually designed to kill Soviet soldiers and commanders. Casey endorsed these techniques, despite the qualms of some CIA career officers. Casey never argued for attacks on purely civilian targets, but he was inclined toward aggressive force. In the worldwide anti-terror campaign Casey began to envision during 1985, Afghanistan offered one way to attack the Soviet aggressors. "We're arming the Afghans, right?" Casey asked during one of the debates of this period. He wanted authority to strike at Middle Eastern terrorists preemptively. "Every time a Mujahideen rebel kills a Soviet rifleman, are we engaged in assassination? This is a rough business. If we're afraid to hit the terrorists because somebody's going to yell assassination, it'll never stop. The terrorists will own the world." At the CIA station in Islamabad, the new era arrived in the form of visiting delegations from Washington. Pentagon officers carrying satellite maps, special forces commandos offering a course in advanced explosives, and suitcase-carrying congressional visitors who wanted Disney-quality tours of Mujahideen camps and plenty of time to buy hand-woven carpets. William Pinckney tried to move them all cheerfully through the turnstiles. With senior delegations, he might drive them to ISI's unmarked headquarters for tea and talk with General Akhtar. E. Clay and Pillsbury touched down in Islamabad on April 30, 1985. They could not legally disclose the existence of NSDD 166, but they wanted Akhtar to understand its expansive goals. During a 2-hour private conversation at the ISI chief's residence, E. Clay was able to convey the thrust of the president's new decision directive, as Pillsbury put it. The visitors wanted to pump up Akhtar's ambitions when he submitted quarterly lists of weapons needed by the Mujahideen. The CIA's Afghan supply system depended on these formal requests. Soon the classified lists cabled in from Islamabad included anti-aircraft missiles, long-range sniper rifles, night vision goggles, delayed timing devices for plastic explosives, and electronic intercept equipment. The new requests made it harder than ever to maintain plausible deniability about the CIA's role in the jihad. This made the agency's professional secret keepers uncomfortable. But even the most reflexively clandestine among them recognized that by 1985, the Soviet leadership had already learned the outlines of the CIA's Afghan program from press reports, captured fighters, intercepted communications, and KGB-supervised espionage operations carried out among the rebels. Even the American public knew the outlines of Langley's work from newspaper stories and television documentaries. Increasingly, as the CIA and its gung-ho adversaries argued over the introduction of more sophisticated weapons, the issue was not whether the existence of an American covert supply line could be kept secret, but whether the supply of precision American arms would provoke the Soviets into raiding Pakistan or retaliating against Americans. Pikeney Station began to run more and more unilateral intelligence agents across the Afghan border. The swelling volume of weapons shipments, the rising number of questions from visiting congressmen about ISI ripoffs, and the worsening violence on the Afghan battlefield all argued for deeper and more independent CIA reporting. To some extent, it was a matter of protecting the CIA from intensifying congressional oversight. The agency needed to be able to demonstrate that it was independently auditing the large new flows of weaponry. It could not do so credibly if it relied only on Pakistani intelligence for its reporting. Some of the CIA's unilateral reporting agents were Afghans. Hart's relationship with Abdul Haq was passed along to Pikeney, for instance. But most of the new agents who traveled in Afghanistan on the CIA's behalf during the mid-1980s were European adventurers. These included European journalists, photographers, and ex-Foreign Legion members. Pikeney's connections from his previous tour in Paris helped with the recruitments. Warren Merrick, an undeclared CIA case officer operating out of the American consulate in Karachi, away from ISI surveillance in Islamabad, handled many of the Europeans. After they flew into Karachi from France or Belgium, Merrick would hook them up with trusted Afghan guides and sometimes provide false papers and cover identities. A few of the European agents were given secure communications gear so they could send in timely reports from the Afghan battlefield, but most went across the border carrying only notebooks and cameras. When they came out, Merrick would fly them quickly to Europe for debriefings. The photographs these agents took provided the CIA with its own archive of close-up pictures of battlefield damage, Soviet weapons systems, and troop deployments. The agents' first-hand reports about Afghan commanders also provided a check on ISI claims about weapons handouts. And the Europeans came cheap, usually taking in the range of only $1,000 a month. They weren't in it for the money. They sought adventure. For their part, politically savvy Afghan commanders began to understand by 1985 that one way to lobby for weapons and power, and to outflank ISI's controlling brigadiers, was to build their own independent relationships in Washington or Riyadh. The Islamist radicals tended to cultivate wealthy patrons in Saudi Arabia. Sayaf lectured there so often that he was awarded the kingdom's King Faisal Intellectual Prize during 1985. The self-described moderate Afghan rebel leaders with ties to the old royal family or the country's mystical Sufi brotherhoods relied more on support from Europe and Washington, particularly from Capitol Hill. A parade of well-tailored Gucci Mouge, as the CIA Near East officers derisively called them, began to fly in from Pakistan and march from office to office in Washington. Those Afghans who felt neglected by Pakistani intelligence tended to be the most active in Washington. These included the royalist Pashtuns from the Durrani Tribal Federation, whose political ancestry made them unattractive to the Pakistan army. They swore allegiance to former King Zahir Shah, who lived in exile in a villa outside Rome. They denounced Pakistani intelligence for its aid to Hekmatyar, from the rival Gilzai Tribal Federation, whom they regarded as a dangerous megalomaniac. Gradually, too, Ahmed Shah Massoud's brothers and Panjshiri aides began to make the rounds in Washington. Massoud's now widely publicized record as a war hero in the harsh Panjshir gave him more clout and credibility than the Durrani Pashtuns, who tended to be dismissed, especially at Langley, as political self-promoters with weak battlefield records. The CIA's Near East Division found itself under rising pressure to direct more of the money and weapons flowing from NSDD-166's escalation toward Massoud. Yet the agency still had only the most tenuous connections to Massoud. The CIA tended to view all the Washington lobbying as evidence of innate Afghan factionalism, not as an expression of dissent about Pakistani intelligence policy. It was quite a spectacle as the bearded and robed Mujahideen political leaders went from office to office, building to building, making their personal and parochial cases for support, Directorate of Intelligence Chief Robert Gates wrote later. No one should have had any illusions about these people coming together politically, before or after a Soviet defeat. The CIA's leadership continued to regard Pakistani intelligence as the jihad's main implementing agency, even as more and more American trainers arrived in Pakistan to teach new weapons and techniques. All this ensured that ISI's Muslim Brotherhood-inspired clients, mainly Hekmatyar, but also Sayaf, Rabbani, and radical commanders who operated along the Pakistan border, such as Jalaluddin Haqqani, won the greatest share of support. From its earliest days, the Afghan war had been brutal, characterized by indiscriminate aerial bombing and the widespread slaughter of civilians. After 6 years, the CIA, ISI, KGB, and Soviet special forces had all refined their tactics. Now, as the new American policy blueprint put it, each side sought to demoralize, sabotage, frighten, and confuse its enemy by whatever means necessary. As the Afghan Operations Director for Pakistani Intelligence between 1983 and 1987, Brigadier Mohammad Yousef was Akhtar's barbarian handler, as one CIA colleague put it, quoting an old Chinese moniker. Yousef ran the clandestine training camps, kept the books on weapons handouts, received the new satellite maps, and occasionally accompanied Mujahideen groups on commando missions. His strategy was death by a thousand cuts. He emphasized attacks on Soviet command targets in Kabul. He saw the capital as a center of gravity for the Soviets. If the city became a secure sanctuary, Soviet generals might never leave. ISI supplied Afghan guerrillas detonated a briefcase bomb under a dining room table at Kabul University in 1983, killing 9 Soviets, including a female professor. Yousef and the Afghan car bombing squads he trained regarded Kabul University professors as fair game, since they were poisoning young minds with Marxist anti-Islamic dogma. Mujahideen commandos later assassinated the university's rector. 7 Soviet military officers were reported shot dead by Kabul assassins in a single year. By Yousef's estimation, car bombing squads trained by Pakistan and supplied with CIA-funded explosives and detonators made numerous attempts to kill the chief of the Afghan secret police, the notorious torturer Najibullah, but they repeatedly failed to get him. Fear of poisoning, surprise attacks, and assassination became rife among Russian officers and soldiers in Kabul. The rebels fashioned booby-trapped bombs from gooey black contact explosives supplied to Pakistani intelligence by the CIA that could be molded into ordinary shapes or poured into innocent utensils. Russian soldiers began to find bombs made from pens, watches, cigarette lighters, and tape recorders. Hidden death has been camouflaged so masterfully that only someone with a practiced eye can see it, the independent Russian writer Artyom Borovik reported during his travels. Kabul shopkeepers poisoned food eaten by Russian soldiers. Assassins lurked in the city's mud-rock alleys. A rhyme invented by Russian conscripts went, "Afghanistan, a wonderland. Just drop into a store, and you'll be seen no more." Across the Pakistan border, Yousef saw himself treading a careful line between guerrilla war and terrorism. "We are as good or bad a civilized nation as anyone living in the West," he said later, "because when you carry out this sort of operation, it has a double edge." His squads bombed Kabul cinemas and cultural shows, but the attacking Afghan guerrillas knew that most of their victims would be the Soviet soldiers. "Otherwise," Yousef said, "you will not find any case of poisoning the water or any use of chemical or biological." Car bombs were supposed to be targeted only at military leaders, he said later. By all accounts, there were few car bombings aimed at civilians during this period. However, once the uncontrolled mortaring of Kabul began in 1985, after the CIA shipped in Egyptian and Chinese rockets that could be remotely fired from long range, random civilian casualties in the city began to mount steadily. The CIA officers that Yousef worked with closely impressed upon him one rule: never use the terms sabotage or assassination when speaking with visiting congressmen. The KGB had no such worries. By 1985, Soviet and Afghan intelligence operatives played a greater role in the counterinsurgency campaign than ever before. Najibullah, the secret police chief, was elevated to the Afghan Politburo in November 1985. By the following spring, Moscow had sacked Babrak Karmal and appointed Najibullah as Afghanistan's president. His ruling councils were filled with ruthless intelligence operatives. The KGB-trained Afghan intelligence service swelled to about 30,000 professionals and 100,000 paid informers. Its domestic directorates, lacking cooperative sources among the population, routinely detained and tortured civilians in search of insight about Mujahideen operations. The Afghan service also ran foreign operations in Iran and Pakistan. It maintained secret residencies in Quetta, Peshawar, Islamabad, New Delhi, Karachi, and elsewhere, communicating to Kabul through Soviet embassies and consulates. By planting agents in refugee camps, Afghan intelligence gradually penetrated the Mujahideen. Frustrated by the copious new supplies pouring into Afghanistan, the Soviet 40th Army deployed intelligence teams and helicopter-borne Spetsnaz special forces to try to seal the Pakistan border during 1985. They failed, but they wreaked havoc in the effort. Spetsnaz units dispatched high-tech communications intercept vehicles called Omsk vans to track Mujahideen movements from Peshawar or Quetta. When they located a convoy, they sent the new fearsome MiG-24D helicopters on intercept missions across the barren Pakistani hills. The helicopters would fly 5 or 10 miles inside Pakistan, then swing around and move up behind the Mujahideen as they slouched along canyon paths or desert culverts. Spetsnaz commandos poured out and ambushed the rebels. Increasingly, Russian special forces captured Mujahideen equipment, such as their ubiquitous Japanese-made pickup trucks, which were shipped in by the CIA. The Russian special forces began to operate in disguise, dressed as Islamic rebels. The KGB also ran false bands of Mujahideen across Afghanistan, paying them to attack genuine rebel groups in an attempt to sow dissension. Mujahideen operating along the Pakistan border took heavy casualties in these Spetsnaz helicopter raids. They also had a few rare successes. Pakistani intelligence captured from Soviet defectors and handed over to Pikeney the first intact MiG-24D ever taken in by the CIA. Langley ordered a team to Islamabad to load the dismantled prize onto a transport jet and fly it back to the United States. Its exploitation saved the Pentagon millions of dollars in research and development costs, the Pentagon later reported. Encouraged by the CIA, Pakistani intelligence also focused on sabotage operations that would cut Soviet supply lines. But the missions often proved difficult, because even the most ardent Afghan Islamists refused to mount suicide operations. In his Wile E. Coyote-style efforts to blow up the Salang Tunnel north of Kabul, Yusuf tried to concoct truck bomb missions in which ISI would help load fuel tankers with explosives. Soviet soldiers moved quickly to intercept any truck that stalled inside the strategic tunnel, so there seemed no practical way to complete such a mission unless the truck driver was willing to die in the cause. The Afghans whom Yusuf trained uniformly denounced suicide attack proposals as against their religion. It was only the Arab volunteers from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Algeria, and other countries who had been raised in an entirely different culture, spoke their own language, and preached their own interpretations of Islam while fighting far from their homes and families, who later advocated suicide attacks. Afghan jihadists, tightly woven into family, clan, and regional social networks, never embraced suicide tactics in significant numbers. Afghan fighters also often refused to attack bridges or trade routes if they were important to civilian traders or farmers. The Afghan tolerance of civilian commerce in the midst of dire conflict frustrated visiting Americans. A congressman on tour would fly over Afghanistan, see a bridge standing unmolested, and complain loudly on his return to Washington that it ought to be blown up. But when the satellite-mapped attack plan was passed down through ISI to a particular Afghan commando team, the Afghans would often shrug off the order or use the supplied weapons to hit a different target of their own choosing. They took tolls from bridges. The livelihood of their clan often depended on open roads. Still, the CIA shipped to Pakistani intelligence many tons of C4 plastic explosives for sabotage operations during this period. Britain's MI6 provided magnetic depth charges to attack bridge pylons, particularly the bridge near Termez that spanned the Amu Darya.